When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to KTIM Presents Coppola Connections, as ever brought to you by the Breadcrumbs Collective and hosted by me, Petros Patsilivas. If you're new to this old here podcast, what we do here is we watch every single film in the collective Coppola family filmography to determine if they are the greatest film family of all time. I don't do that alone, however, I'm joined by a guest who will answer the question of, based on this film alone, are they the greatest film family of all time? And this week's film for episode 56 is Meet the Fockers, and our fantastic guest is Rich Wiltshire. One is finally out of the bag. They are a podcast who like to do their scheduling under the cover of darkness. The listeners not to know until things are revealed. Speaking of things being revealed, on this episode we'll be talking about Meet the Fockers in all of its gory details. Every blow-by-blow, every truth told, every family feud will be discussed. So if you haven't seen this film, go watch it. It's streaming here in the UK on Netflix, and I'm sure it'll be streaming elsewhere. All you got to do is Google that bad boy. I'm sure it'll let you know if it is streaming. So I guess with all of that out of the way, all that's left to do is to pack up your RV, head on down to Florida, meet your future in-laws, kind of, other side of the family that you haven't met in the first film, get a little kid to say arsehole as we make some Coppola connections. To a lot of us, family means everything. When two families come together, they can come together in total harmony. It can be a wonderful thing. Or it could be an utter disaster. On to this week's film. We're looking at the comedy sequel to the smash hit Meet the Parents, 2004's Meet the Fockers, directed by Jay Roach, written by Jim Hirschfeld and John Hamburg. The film stars Ben Stiller, Terry Polo, Robert De Niro, Blythe Danner, Dustin Hoffman and Barbara Streisand. Film cinematographer and today's Coppola connection, our boy, John Schwartzman, to join me to find out if the Coppola family are just a load of old repressed old fuddy-duddies stuck in their ways, or they're free, loving and open, is a man who's used to the world of sequels. One half of the excellent Unequal Sequel podcast, Rich Wiltshire. How are you, Rich?
I'm good, thank you, mate. I'm good. I think I've drawn a short straw on this one. They've got to do Rocky Five. Like, my fellow podcast host on Unequal Sequel, the two of us, we're like, we've got to do sequels. We've got to pick a sequel from this list. And then Dave just got in there before me with Rocky Five. And I was like, okay, I'll do Meet the Fockers.
Yeah, I should have a look and see if you've missed any sequel. I'm not sure if you've missed any sequels on the list.
I think it's a short list of sequels.
Yeah, they seem, yeah, and I guess the ultimate sequels in the kind of Coppola pantheon of filmography are the Godfather,
yeah, and I imagine they went fast.
yeah, but I think they're ones that I'll be able to dine out on in many ways for the foreseeable. I reckon I could get to the end of doing the complete family filmography and just do like a Godfather scene by scene, and people would still listen, I reckon. I even recently saw that Les Dennis, of all people, was saying that, like, The Godfather has one of the best opening scenes of all time. Then he immediately was like, I was like, Les, come speak to me, brother. Like, come on. I already had the pop quiz ready and the Family Fortunes sound on the soundboard just ready for him.
Fantastic.
Who was the cinematographer on this film? He says someone else. It's actually Gordon Willis. get at Les Dennis.
Brilliant.
And I think that would have been like the one time my parents would have been like, wow. You've got Les Dennis. You're really That's going impressive. Somewhere with this podcast. Not me normally having to, like, if I get a big name, having to explain what they're from, and they're like, yeah, we lost interest about 5 minutes ago. So before we get going, Rich, tell us, obviously, yeah, Dave's been on the podcast before, but time moves quickly. That was like 5-6 weeks ago, so people may have already forgotten. Tell us a little bit about Unequal Sequel and what you guys do over there.
I mean, it's a pretty simple concept, really. We get a guest on and we ask them what their best sequel, their worst sequel, and their dream sequel are. And because we just like having a rambly chat, we end up sort of talking about their life in general based on sequels. So we get a nice kind of insight into our guests' past and history and psyche through the medium of sequels.
So doing the show, like, obviously you guys probably are constantly thinking about yours. How often? I'm not going to ask you what they are, so, because I know that will inevitably be an episode, but how often in your head does it change? Like, the kind of, is there stuff that you watch or the podcast and be like, oh, that's maybe pipped it, or someone said something that, oh yeah, like, I could
see. There's definitely been things we've watched for the podcast, especially kind of worst sequels, when I'm like, yes, that is a very bad sequel. That's definitely opened my eyes in worst sequels. We've had a few movies that people have picked as their like dream sequel that I've watched, and I've been like, oh, hello. So things like The Guest or Booksmart that I'd never seen before, I've only watched because people have picked them as their dream sequel. And then also got into the kind of the Before trilogy. So like Before Sunset, Before Midnight, all those kind of things. Because I'd never heard of those before either for the podcast. So yeah, kind of got into them as well. So there's a few, but I still think my best sequel is still the same and nobody's picked it yet. So I'm crossing my fingers that we'll get to that point where we get to do our own ones and nobody picks it. But yeah, and I think maybe my worst sequel is the one that changes the most. It was Sex and the City 2 for a long time, mainly because the Kathy and Dave from the Cinemile picked that as their worst sequel, and then changed their minds. And so I watched it for absolutely no reason. So I was like determined for someone to pick that, and luckily we had a Shanti Omkar on the podcast, and she picked it. So thankfully, I didn't watch it for nothing because it's fucking awful.
Yeah,
sorry.
It is that thing when, like, looking at like bad. Obviously, there is like a kind of cottage industry of like terrible sequels, and like I kind of fall down rabbit holes of looking at stuff on like Wikipedia and stuff, and I'm always fascinated by, I guess they're like faux sequels where like a studio picks up a film that's already been made and they just turn it into a sequel. I recently, maybe like 2 years ago now, I picked up 8mm 2.
Is that a thing?
It is, but it is one of those like by name, like it was something else,
like before. S Darko.
Yeah, like. Or like American Psycho 2. They kind of make a couple of tweaks and like go, yeah, this is a sequel to that. And it's like, is it though? Like, or is this like you really like cynically just, do you know what I mean? Like trying to swindle people into just like by name recognition going, yeah, I better give that a go. Like, it's, I think it's that same thing of all those straight to DVD movies that use like the same colorway or like a poster of a famous film. And then, do you know what I mean? Like, your dad in Asda on a Friday night whilst he's picking up some lagers and a middle-aged man just goes, oh yeah, that looks vaguely like June. Yeah, I'll pick that up. And you get it home and it's like June Reckoning and it's some like straight to DVD movie where it's like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah, it's always got that subtitle. It's always like Requiem, yes, or Reckoning or something like that. And you're like, that's when you know it's going to be bad.
amazing. Well, yeah, I could talk to you about sequels all night because they're a fast. Oh, and I'm going to about a particular one. But before we get to Meet the Fockers, I'd like to know, yeah, your kind of Coppola credentials and your way into the Coppola family. When did you kind of become aware of them as an entity, but who was your entry point? Was there like a certain member of the family you saw, yeah, whose film you would have seen first?
So probably unknowingly, it's probably Nicolas Cage, but I didn't realize he was a Coppola at that at that point. So it would have been things like Face Off and Con Air and The Rock and all those classic kind of Nick Cage movies that are just brilliant. But I think my first real kind of realization of the Coppola family was actually probably not The Godfather. I didn't watch The Godfather until a little bit too late. I was at uni by the time I watched Godfather. But I remember catching Apocalypse Now on like Film 4 when I was about 17 or 18, and thinking, Christ, this is incredible.
Yeah.
This thing is amazing. And so that was my first kind of Francis Ford Coppola. And then obviously like Lost in Translation. So I was like, oh, hang on, this has come along. And then, yeah, I was horrifically late to The Godfather. And I didn't watch The Godfather Part 2 until we started doing the podcast. So it was only like a year ago that I watched The Godfather Part 2. And I still haven't seen Part 3.
Well, there's something like fascinating about, because there's so many people who would have watched, like, because I was one, and I never really said, I don't know, for ages I would say, I really haven't watched The Godfather because I maybe watched it when I was like 13. And I think like sometimes it's good to just like, I do it with films. There's loads of great films I haven't seen. And like now I kind of put them off and be like, that's in my back pocket. Like everyone says this is great. Or like people like I know and trust go like, you'll love that. Like I've never seen Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And I'm like, loads of people say to me like, you'll love that. And I'm like, well, I've got that in my back pocket of like, do you know what I mean? When I'm kind of like,
when you're in the right place.
Yeah, I'll be like, yeah. Or like when you get to a certain age, do you know what I mean? Like some films, like there's films that I really love from the past like few years. Like, yeah, I watched Come On, Come On last year. And I was like, I reckon if I'd seen that as a teenager, I'd have been like, what's this black and white guff? Do you know what I mean? But watching it as like a 31-year-old, like father of one, who, like I was like, oh yeah, this is a film about a guy who creates essentially podcasts and he's trying to connect with a young child. I was like, this film kind of hit me at the perfect time in my life, and I think to bring it back to The Godfather, I think when you watch it young, like 12, 13. You kind of watch it on that surface level of, oh, there's shooting and stuff like that. But then if you really think about it, and I probably had that opinion when I was younger, it's like, it's a proper, like, I was like, it's a dad movie. Do you know what I mean? It's a lot of talking.
Yeah.
A lot of talking
definitely
in rooms.
A dad movie.
And then watching it later, you put like, I don't know how your thingy to it was, but like,
I kind of watched it. So I'd started university when I watched it, and we did a module on like gangster movies, and a lot of it was British gangster movies. The Godfather obviously kind of comes up quite prevalently in that. So I thought, do you know what? It's a big hole in my film knowledge. I better watch it. And so at the time, I was kind of like looking out for all the kind of like the mise-en-scene and the kind of the filmmaking and the cues that it gives you visually to other things. And, you know, that, so I'm watching it very much from a film studies kind of perspective, rather than just kind of watching it for enjoyment, really. So maybe I need to go back and watch it again to like get it for a purely pleasurable kind of perspective.
Yeah.
Because in my head, it just exists as like this kind of thing that I studied, you know, like this, this thing that, yeah.
Earlier this year, I watched it like probably more than somebody should in like a quick succession. I think I watched it like 3 or 4 times, like in the space of like 6 weeks. Cause I was like, I'm doing an episode on it. I've really got to like soak this film in and like got to see it for the new 4K restoration at the cinema and stuff like that. And it is one of those, and it's kind of set, it's said about so much stuff, but like, you do get something new from it each time. And like one of the, like when I saw it at the cinema, I was like, this is going to be a totally purely enjoyable experience. Do you know what I mean? Like I went out to like a local Italian deli, bought myself some cannolis to like sneak into the cinema. Like, I was like, I'm going to really, and like kind of when the famous line, like leave the gun, take the cannoli came on, I kind of like, took a cannoli out of the bag, like, here we go. It was all good until I got like a nut stuck down my throat, and I was like, I've got like 2 hours left, and I'm nearly choking in the cinema. Like,
oh god, on illegal food I've smuggled in.
Yeah. My bottle of pop had run out as well. I'm like,
oh, nightmare.
I'm going to turn blue like Luca Brasi and just die in a screening of The Godfather. But I would always recommend someone watch it for purely pleasure reasons. But yeah, it's I was just going to say it's great. Like nobody's ever said that before. I'd really sincerely go, yeah, it's really great. Like you don't know that.
Well, this is the thing. Like everybody says it's great, and you know, and everyone says that Part Two is the best sequel ever. And do you know what? I'm probably the only person who doesn't like Part Two as much as the first part. Potentially, everyone, you know, a lot of people think that Part Two is better than Part One. I don't know. I don't think it is for me. I think it's, I like the De Niro side of the story more than I like the Pacino side of the story.
I've said this before with Part Two, is that part one is a more enjoyable watch. It's a rewatchable movie, whereas Part Two is like, you kind of watch it and go, wow, that is really impressive. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Like
the kind of balancing act of the two timelines going on, the kind of the mirroring and the kind of like that thing of one man's ascent to being something and one man's like decline into kind of madness and deception and just like evil.
It's kind of
like really operatic, really great. And it is that thing of like, whereas number one is like, it's pretty just fun. It's quite funny. And like number two is like, let's kind of strip all that away. And I think that's why it's like Part Two. It's like we're just descending further into hell. Do you know what I mean? It's like,
it doesn't feel as, I think with Part Two, it doesn't feel as instantly quotable as Part One. You know, like everyone sort of gets the Part One, like, you come to me on the day of my daughter's wedding. Like, you know, that kind of, there are lines from Part One you can quote. I don't think I could quote anything much from Part Two, really.
No, I guess one and three have like ultimate quotable lines. You've got three, you've got the, just when I thought I was out, they pulled me back in. Like,
Is that from three? I've not seen three yet, I still need to watch it.
It's good for that line alone. two, if anything, it's probably got one of the most like gif-able moments ever with the kind of any act of betrayal. Like my go-to thing, if someone's like slighted me or just like, I'm joking, to be like, you've slighted me, I just go for the Michael Fredo kiss. Do you know, like when he's like, I knew it was you, Fredo, like that. Like, but you don't, I don't know. And unless you're kind of with your like film friends. You, like, if you just said to somebody, you, do you know what I mean? Oh, I knew it was you, Fredo. They'd probably look at you like, why is he talking, why is he talking about, like,
Everly, that happens a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Ever-increasing price chocolate right now. Oh, I'm not talking about Fredo bars, guys. I'm talking about The Godfather Part 2. Why is he calling me Fredo? I definitely get you on that point. Now, have you ever met a Coppola, Rich? It's kind of, you never know.
I very much doubt it. but no, I don't think I have, no. Unless, the only time I would, unless any of them cropped up on Midsummer Murders. So I did an internship on Midsummer Murders when I was at uni. And that's about the closest I would ever get to, like, filmmaking, really, unfortunately.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm not going to have to do a mini series on, like, a run of Midsummer Murders because, no Coppola are involved. But
John Nettles is not a Coppola.
No, last time I checked, no, he's not on the family tree. Unfortunately, amazing. Any juicy goss from the set of Midsummer Murders?
I mean, we're talking 20 years ago, so no, not really. Other than if you watch very closely, you can see my feet a couple of times, okay. Where I, like, had to, yeah, be like a dead body. And my other friend Rich, was with me. He was a dead body and a donkey at one point.
Did you know this kind of stuff, like, beforehand, or is it, like, on the day? Being like,
No. When you're a runner, you just do what you're told. You just do anything. You just go and do stuff and just, you know, just do it. go and stop traffic. Like, right, fine, put this high vis on and go and stop traffic coming past.
Yeah.
It's like, basically go and be sworn out for 4 hours.
Yeah. one day it's like, can you hold this door closed? Because it creaks. We don't want it to interrupt the sound.
Yeah. Next, yeah.
Can you be a dead body?
Like, yeah, yeah, that's it. Yeah. One day you're a dead body. Next day you're a donkey. Then you're on traffic duty. Next day you bring John Nettles' sandwiches. Like, you know, it's the next day you're hanging out with the props guys who all worked on Gladiator. You know, it's wild.
Perfect. Yeah, yeah. They're all swapping stories about Oliver Reed. Oh, bloody hell. Yeah. That shoot. Bloody hell. The secret life of a runner. There you go. Yeah. Amazing. So what would have been the first film you would have seen that John Swartzman was the cinematographer on?
Oh, wow. Okay. Right. That's interesting. I don't know. Let's have a think. So what has he done? So other than this, EdTV maybe,
I
think.
He's pretty prolific. So he did Armageddon. Yeah. He did Airheads.
He did do The Rock. Yeah, I think The Rock was probably the first one then, I should think. He did Pearl Harbor as well, didn't he?
Yeah, like, I always think about it, like, he is kind of instrumental in Michael Bay's aesthetic in a way.
He's
kind of like, he was there, like, in the kind of testing ground for Michael Bay kind of figuring out his whole thing, which is like, I don't know, it's like, whatever your feelings on Michael Bay are, it's like, is John Swartzman just as culpable as Michael Bay?
do you know what the first movie I would have seen was, he did Benny and June.
Yes.
And I quite like that movie. I've always quite liked that movie. That's probably the first one I actually saw. But yeah, if he's responsible, he didn't do the Transformers movie, so did he? Because... you know, they are an abomination. So, but yeah, I think, Michael Bay has a lot to answer for. I'm not going to blame John Schwartzman for those atrocities.
See, I've got like a real love-hate relationship with Michael Bay. I'm kind of like, I'm this is becoming a running thing on this podcast. I'm a massive fan of Ambulance. Like, I absolutely...
I've not seen it, but then I genuinely dislike Michael Bay's work mostly. So Bad Boys is acceptable, and then I think everything else I don't like.
Not even Armageddon. You don't like Armageddon?
I mean...
The Rock!
I forgot The Rock was Michael Bay. No, I do like The Rock, that's true. Armageddon's very schlocky. I don't know. I just kind of, I don't hate it. I don't hate it, but I wouldn't put it in my kind of, you know, like this is a movie I love kind of thing. But The Rock, you're right. I forgot about The Rock. That's a great movie.
What is crazy about those two films is they are both in the Criterion Collection. Armageddon.
Are they?
Yeah. So you think about all of the kind of great talents who don't have films in the Criterion Collection. Michael Bay has two.
Jesus. Madness.
And
madness.
If I had my way, he'd have three with Ambulance because it's great.
I've not seen it. So you could be right.
That's
like maybe it's the best movie that I've not seen.
That's for everyone at home with their bingo cards waiting for me to mention
waiting to
Ambulance.
Tick it off.
Yeah, mention Ambulance. So, speaking of John Swartzman, well, let's talk about Meet the Fockers. But before we do, let's have a listen to the trailer.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Captain Jack Byrne speaking.
Yay!
We should be arriving at the Fokker family residence in approximately 0900 hours.
A man reaches a certain age when he realizes what's truly important. You know what that is?
Love, friendship, just love, I think.
His legacy.
That too.
If your family circle joins my family circle, they'll form a chain. I can't have a chink in my chain.
Is that your father?
Boom!
That is my father.
Jack Burns, Em's father.
Give me some love.
No.
What are you so shy about? Come here.
That's a good icebreaker.
Hello, I'm Roz Fokker.
Look, son, I've displayed all your awards.
I didn't know they made ninth place ribbons.
They have them up to 10th place. There's a bunch of them on the A for Effort shelf there.
My family's a little quirky.
I'm a sex therapist who specializes in senior sexuality.
But they're really well-intentioned.
Greggy practically slept in our bed till he was 10.
Oh, I don't think it was quite that long.
Yeah, it was that long. And your parents are great.
Guys, come on, cut it out.
Trust me, your dad is very worried there's going to be a chink in the chain.
Tina, you and I'll take on Jack and Roz. Come on, Jack, it'll be fun. We'll swap wives.
Universal Pictures and DreamWorks Pictures present.
I'm not so sure this wedding is such a good idea. I don't like what I'm seeing from these fuckers.
You seem anxious. Let me work out the kinks.
Don't!
I was trying to do you a favor.
You were riding him like Seabiscuit. Just make Jack feel a little more comfortable here.
Morning, partner.
Robert De Niro, Ben Stiller, Dustin Hoffman, and Barbara Streisand.
Just make sure Moses doesn't go in there. They have a cat.
JT, don't do it.
No!
Moses!
The cat can flush?
That's my toilet!
Close your mouth, Moses!
Meet the Fockers.
Going good so far, right?
Still, I don't know what to do. So, Meet the Fockers was made on a budget of $80 million and had a box office return of $522.7 million and was released on December 22nd, 2004. Rich, would you like to do us the honour of telling us what this film is all about?
It's quite a running joke on our podcast that Dave will often spring things on me and ask me to do synopsis of film off the top of my head, and I'm rubbish at it, so I apologise in advance. Essentially, it follows on from the first movie, Meet the Parents, where Greg Gaylord Fokker meets his to-be wife's parents, played by Robert De Niro, and I can't remember who it is who plays his wife, sorry.
Live Dana?
Yes, yeah, you're on it. And yeah, they essentially Robert De Niro's next CIA agent, so he grills Greg, tries to find out everything about him. And obviously, it's quite a nice kind of fish out of water kind of film because Greg is the sensible one. In this movie, they get to meet Greg's parents, who are very kind of hippie, very opposite to the other parents, and it's kind of that awkward how they kind of gel together as two families. Yeah.
One of the things I thought whilst watching this film is kind of, I'm going to say it up front because it would kind of just be like burning a hole in my brain to say it. Is it felt like a not so good version of The Birdcage, if you've ever seen that.
I've not seen The Birdcage, no, but...
So that is like, yeah, so Robin Williams and Nathan Lane play a gay couple and their son is like marrying someone. And
I think I have seen The Birdcage. That does ring a bell, yeah.
Her parents are played by Diane Wiest and Gene Hackman. And they're like super conservative. He's like a kind of Republican, a like senator or something. Yeah, to that effect. And then it's like, it's got that element of like, you need to diminish yourself in order to impress these people. And like Nathan Lane, a film that has been covered on this here podcast because it has a Coppola connection. But I just felt all the way through watching it, I was like, oh, this just feels like The Birdcage, but nowhere near as fun.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing, isn't it? It's actually not that funny. Like the first one is that, like, it gets its fun from Ben Stiller's character being like the normal one, like the relatable one, the one you kind of relate with, and you feel bad for him because he's going through all this torture from De Niro, essentially. And De Niro is very straight. You know, it's not cracking gags or anything. Whereas this second one kind of relies on De Niro to be a bit more of the comedy chops, essentially. And, you know, I don't think it pays off very well. The cast is great. And I think the major thing this movie does that's impressive is makes such a good cast so bad.
Yeah. And so before we kind of, dig into it and kind of really pick apart like what kind of works and predominantly what doesn't work in this film, when would you have first seen this film? Would you have said, like, did you have a relationship to the first film? Were you anticipating seeing this?
Not really. I think I was talking this over with Dave. I'm 80% sure I saw this on a date. So I'm pretty sure I went to watch it on a date. We would have been at university. So I would have been like Cineworld in Cheltenham, would have been on a date. And I got to be honest, the movie does not stick out.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm 90% sure that I was not concentrating on the movie at the time.
I thought back to like when did I first see this, and this was definitely one I remember. Seeing in the cinema, I would have been like 13 when this film came out, and I like probably would have like been like, ooh, like it's a play on the word fuck, like in the title is fucker, and like the film very much knows that as well. Like any opportunity, God.
There's so many jokes about the fucker name.
Like, yeah. I'm gonna be Martha Fuck. I'm gonna be Pam Martha Fucker. I know how that sounds. Like, oh, have you met Randy and Orny?
Yeah. Like, who's called Orny?
Come on. But like, I would have said it then, and I remember like having a pirate tape of this, okay. Like. I don't know why. Maybe like my parents. Like, yeah, I remember enjoying the first one, and I'm going to like be up front here. I intended to watch both of them, but then I realized time is precious and life is fleeting. And do I really want to give away 4 hours of my life potentially just for some background research? And from like putting it out to Twitter and like social media, I kind of think like, I don't know. I should
people
have
like
watched
this
the
movie.
First one. I should have watched the first one.
A lot better. Yeah. The first one's a lot better, and obviously the third one is a lot worse by all accounts. I've not seen the third one, but from what everybody says, the third one is an abomination. This is not. It's just. It's all right. It's not terrible. It's just...
I just have like a lot of questions. Because obviously it's a four-year gap between the two films.
Yeah.
What, like, first of all, when the film starts, it's like, what is the gap between the events of the first one and this one?
I mean, it can't be that long, surely. Like, it's not, we're talking like a year or so, I would think. Surely, it can't be that long.
Yeah, because how, like, and I think the sticking point is, like, one, how old is that kid? And how old is that kid meant to be? Like, that, yeah. I think that is one of the big things in this. It's like, right, so little Jack, how old is he meant to be? Like, first word, like, what we speak, we're thinking anything from 9 months to 18 months, maybe.
Yeah, it
could be later.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, got to be that kind of time. Yeah. So was she little Jack is the sister's kid, right?
Who is totally absent from this film. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, who's completely not in it. Yeah. But the sister's not pregnant in the first one, is she? Or is, I don't know. So maybe it's a bit longer than a year.
Maybe she is.
I can't remember. I can't remember.
Yeah, this is probably why I should have. All I remember from the first one involving the sisters, I'm pretty sure that he spikes a volleyball
and like into her nose. Yeah,
breaks
her
nose.
Yeah, that's what, like, I was thinking.
Which would have been even worse if he did that to a pregnant woman.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't think she is pregnant. I think so. It must be. It's got to be a good couple of years then in that case between the two. All right.
But then it feels totally, like, just logically, like, from that, it just doesn't make sense, because it feels like it's the first time she's meeting his parents, or is it? Like,
she definitely says that, like, she's met them before. Like, they definitely talk like they've met before. So maybe that makes more sense.
But it just doesn't, like, I don't know, like, she's sidelined, right? Like, the...
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Pam is totally sidelined. Like, a little nugget of information I found out whilst researching this film is, Terry Polo's career, kind of like she thought, like, or like everyone thought the 1-2 punch of these two films would kind of, I don't know, like, kind of give her career a real kick up the arse, and really didn't. And it somebody has taken the time on Wikipedia to, I just found this very weird and kind of interesting that somebody had put this, is the year after this film, she did a Playboy shoot to kind of try and, like, boost her career again, which I thought was a very bizarre kind of.
Yeah, that is a bit weird. Like, the only other thing I know her from is, like, The West Wing. Like, she's Matt Santos's wife in The West Wing. That's about it. That's the only other thing I can think I know her from.
Yeah, which is, so we talk about the cast of this film. So obviously, yeah, we have Ben Stiller, Terry Polo, we have Bob De Niro, we have Dustin Hoffman, Barbara Streisand. What do you think?
Owen Wilson comes back at the end.
Well, kind of like a thankless task of, like, hey, you're in the first one, come on back. What do you make of Ben Stiller's performance in this film? Like, is it kind of, I don't know, I'm not sure how you feel about it. Like, yeah, you go.
He's just Ben. To me, he's kind of Ben Stiller in every movie. He's the same person, isn't he? Like, you know, I don't think... he sort of plays it well in a sense of, like, the kind of frustration, like the awkwardness and the frustration and the... But it's the same character that he plays in the first one, obviously. But it's the first character, the same as the character he plays in, you know, like Something About Mary, for example. Like, you know, it's like he does feel like that same person.
Like this era, what you've got, like Along Came Polly and stuff like that.
He's again got, same the, character essentially.
The heartbreak kid, like he very much is playing like Ben Stiller. Like,
yeah.
And he has moments where he's like kind of great. I think he does a really good, like, angry. Like, there are moments when he gets to kind of, like, like fly off the handle. And I think there's, yeah, the moment where he just tells everyone to shut up. And it's like, I kind of want more of this. Like, but then it kind of does like something. And yeah, I don't know, a disservice to his character. Because watching it this time, one of the things I realized is like, Greg is just a bit of a dick.
He is a bit of a dick, yeah. He is.
He's
like, there's so many things that wouldn't happen to him if he was an actual functioning human being. Like, yeah, he is a dick.
And it's like just things that you can't really like, yeah, we get it. Like dealing with in-laws or like, do you know what I mean? Your girlfriend's parents and stuff. All of that kind of stuff is difficult. But there is an element where, like, you have got to stand your ground to some degree. Like, do you know what I mean? And just like.
Yeah, but also just relax a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, is it really that bad? Like, come on. You know, you don't have to impress your in-laws that much, you know?
And, like, when it comes to the whole bit where he's, like, trying to diminish who his parents are, which, like. Kind of like feels like an interesting kernel for a film to like that be the kind of tug and pull of the film. But this film kind of overloads it with so much stuff and kind of feels like it's doing similar things to the first one where like the kind of main focus of it is Jack De Niro's character kind of going, don't trust you, Greg.
Yeah, yeah.
And like looking for ways that he doesn't trust him where like, there's moments where it becomes about like the parents and stuff like that. And like the kind of, I don't know.
I feel if my father-in-law was like, I don't trust you, you're not in my circle of trust, I'd be like, all right. Fine.
Yeah. Like, you're not spoke. Like, I don't know. Like, who is that kind of invested to like,
yeah.
Make sure that they like, do you know what I mean? Like, they care about them that much and they want to, like, be in it. Like, I don't want to be, you know what I mean, in a circle. Well, fuck you, mate. Like, it's not me. It's not you I'm trying to make happy. Do you know what I mean? It's your daughter.
Exactly. Like, yeah, yeah. That's it. Like, I'm just like, well, yeah, all right. We'll get on, but, you know, don't need to be in your circle of trust. Cheers, fella.
So, yeah, when talking about the car, let's kind of talk about the people who stand out. Then we'll kind of get to the people who kind of done a disservice in this film.
So the big standout for me, essentially, the one who carries the comedy chops of this movie is the little kid. It's basically the baby. Everything funny that happens in this movie, and let's be honest, the big joke in this movie is a baby saying arsehole.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's the best thing about it. So much so that when my son was about 8-9 months old, I tried really hard to get his first word to be arsehole. It wasn't. My wife wasn't happy. I would sit down with him and go, asshole. No, didn't happen.
That's a question I've got on my sheet. It feels like a perfect time to talk about it. Is it the one son you have, or do you have?
Yeah, just one. Yeah, yeah.
Has he ever like? Was there like a young age where he swore? Like, yeah, is that not really swore?
But I've got a really good video of him where he'd spent the day with my brother, and he came back saying beer. Beer, beer. Like he'd point at stuff and be like beer. And I've got a little video of him just playing with his cars, going beer. Beer. Like he's not staying with you again.
to kind of jump off of that, I've got like a great story of, so my son has just turned 4, maybe when he's like 2.5, and I know exactly who to blame for this. It's my stepdad. He would always they would always play like Duplo Men together, and they'd be like, he had like a kind of construction set, and they would play together and be like, oh, the day's finished, they're going to the pub. And I think my stepdad, one too many times, let they're getting pissed slip from his mouth. And then, so he started to associate going to work, going to the pub, getting pissed. And one day his mum picks him up from my house, like on the handover day, He spends Mondays with my mum because I go to work. And then she said to him, oh, so how was the weekend? And he just kind of totally ignored that question and said, Dada's at work. And she's like, oh, okay. And he's like, yeah, Dada's in the pub. Dada's getting pissed. And I was like, she told me that. And I was like, oh, no. Like,
brilliant. Is that
like my son's, like, is he going around telling people that is what I do? Like, yeah, he's going to work, he's getting pissed.
I remember running a bath for my son about that similar age and like knocking something into the bath and going like, oh, Jesus. And then like, picking it out, and my son going, cheeses, daddy, cheeses.
Amazing. Like, that sounds so much more wholesome. You know what I mean? Yeah. It sounds like a young Wallace from Wallace and Gromit.
Yeah, that's it. Cheeses.
My son sounds like a lout. He's down the pub. He's getting pissed. He's down the nag's head.
Brilliant. My little brother is quite a lot younger than me, and when he was about two. Me and my other brother had taught him to say, instead of burger and chips, we taught him to say bugger and shits. So he's used to be like, I'd go to McDonald's for some bugger and shits.
Amazing.
We weren't popular.
That is the thing. And I think that this film cashes in on the fact that there is something inherently funny about kids swearing.
There is. Like with a rum ball gets stuck to his hand and stuff, and he sat there being like, asshole.
He's watching Scarface. Like, that was a moment when I was like, oh, I'm enjoying this film. And it's because I'm watching Brian De Palma's, like, Scarface right now, but, like, vicariously through this film. Like,
yeah. And that is it. That's the best performance in the film, I think. So let's that little kid.
Let's give a shout out to Spencer and Bradley Pickren, who both played Little Jack, as is common the case.
Good job.
It's actually twins. So, yeah, with the cast, obviously, you mentioned Robert De Niro's like performance in this, and obviously he's got to carry some more of like the comedy weight in this. Like,
yeah.
Why is it that you think it fails? Like, and I guess this is a perfect opportunity to talk about Robert De Niro in comedy, which seems to be like a weird turn for him.
Well, I think it was that kind of time when like Jack Nicholson had done it in About Schmidt, and it was kind of fashionable to bring these kind of actors into comedy. And I think also it was a time when wasn't De Niro kind of down on his luck a little bit, and he was saying yes to a lot of stuff because he had to pay the bills.
I think he was like really into getting real estate, and like obviously he's got like the whole Tribeca Studios and stuff like that. And like, I mean, it's just like, I want to expand this. How can I do it? I could be in Rocky and Bullwinkle. I could be in.
Yeah.
Is he in Analyze This and Analyze That? Is that him in that as well?
I think so. Yeah, something like that. And then he's in like Bad Grandpa and all those kind of things as well, isn't he? Which is just, I just think he has to carry the comedy. He's great as a straight man. And I think, you know, that works really well. And actually, like, if you go back to the start of his career early on, like, to things like Midnight Run, like, you know, he's really good as, like, a straight man in that. And actually, he can do that. I just think when he's lent on for a bit of the comedy, it just doesn't quite pay off. You know, he's not that, he's a different kind of presence.
Like, when you get to the end of this film and he's kind of asking Roz for all of like the tips on how to be like a well-renowned shagger, it's like,
yeah, that's fucking awkward, isn't it?
Like, I don't buy it. I'm like, sentiment, like, and kind of schmaltz with this character, I don't buy it. Like, De Niro doesn't quite like deliver it in the, and it's a real shame. Yeah, I think there was like a thing of like, by the late 90s, it's kind of like star had dipped, and it took a like, you even look to what, like last year, he's in that film like War with My Grandpa, is it? Like,
Like
him and Christopher Walken, like against, like, it's like kind of like Home Alone meets, I don't know, like a battle over a bedroom.
And
like,
I've seen that movie. fucking awful. it's not good. You're right. It's basically a kid objecting to his grandpa staying in his bedroom. I'm like, grow up, kid. Shit happens. I don't know. Yeah, I just think it falls down. In contrast, though, I actually think like Dustin Hoffman and Barbara Streisand are actually really good. Mm-hmm. Like as the Fockers, you know, I think they're a really good, believable kind of hippie couple. And Dustin Hoffman kind of plays it like a teenage boy trapped in an old man's body, essentially. And I think that's the right way to go.
With it, there's some like, yeah, because I think that role was offered to James Brolin originally.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
So, and then Jay Roach had a meeting with Dustin Hoffman, and another name that was floating about was Robin Williams, which I think would have been great. Like, probably could have saved this film. Do you know what I mean? If you had Robin Williams kind of bowed to Dustin Hoffman, was like, nah, like Dustin's the guy. Because, Roach had a meeting with him, and apparently he was just like really chatty and stuff like that. And he's like, oh, that is Bernie. Like, that is the kind of energy we need for this character.
Yeah. And that's, I think they got it right, you know. I think he's good. And yeah, like I said, like Barbara Streisand's actually really good.
Yeah.
Like, you know, of course she's really good. She's really good in everything, but she is, yeah, I think she's particularly good in this, which is a different kind of role than we're used to seeing her in.
Well, I think with those two especially, they look like they're having fun, but yeah, like in the way that's like infectious, not in the way of like, sometimes in comedies you get it where it looks like people are having fun, but we're not invited into the fun. Whereas those two, it is like, they are just like quite fun-loving people. And it's like, I would like to spend time with them. And that's like, when it comes to the whole thing with like Greg trying to diminish them, it's like, I don't know, as a pretty kind of like free, like liberal person myself, I'm like, they're great. Do you know what I mean? If like, yeah. I'm like if they were my parents, I'd be like, yeah, great. Like,
but then don't you always want to be the opposite of your parents? Like,
yeah,
don't you kind of rail against like becoming your parents?
But
you know,
not,
like,
not that my parents are like Jack and Bingy, but like, I kind of like in any way whatsoever. But that it's like just that thing of like, yeah, my family have always been like, yeah, just be who you are. Do you know what I mean? And like,
yeah,
like I'm the kind of weirdo dark sheep in my family, like. loads of people kind of always, it just kind of does his own thing, like that's kind of like quite commendable and stuff like that. And like, it's something I try and like instill in my son and stuff like that. It's like, hey, you are who you are. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I find myself probably like telling people off. Like, yeah, my sister recently said, like, he mentioned a girl's name from play school. She's like, is that your girlfriend? And I was like, don't do that. Don't say that. We don't want to make relationships with females be a weird thing. Like,
no,
he's an impressionable age. Like, stop that shit, right? And I'm probably like, yeah, she's probably there going like, woke arsehole.
Yeah, I would say the same thing to my wife about my son. Like, my son's 7 and a half now. We talk about girlfriends and stuff, and he's like, he just thinks girlfriends are friends. Like, yeah. I was like, don't go down this pushing the whole like girlfriend thing. And like, even when she talks about the dog, she's like, talks about the dog's girlfriend. And I'm like, not his girlfriend. It's just another dog who lives around the corner.
we don't have
to do this.
I just think back to like being a teenager and like any girl I was friends with, like just that kind of mortifying feeling when like a parent would be like, so are they
your girlfriend?
Are they your girlfriend? It's like, no, like it's just someone I enjoy spending time with. Like, and it's like, yeah, I don't want to push that upon. I don't want to push that upon a teenager, let alone a 4-year-old. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Confused as it is of everything that's going on. Do you know what I mean? Like, he'll see somebody he knows out of context and be like bewildered. So don't start throwing concepts like girlfriend at him. Like, he doesn't need that yet. That will come
not
in time.
For a while.
Guess it's time to talk about people who were like given the short end of the stick in this film. And I guess the people, well, no, I don't guess. I know that the people who were given the short end of the stick in this film are Terry Polo and Blythe Danner, who kind of don't really get to do a lot in this film, considering, like, I don't know, there's not that many characters in this film. And it feels like a real shame that these two don't really get their time to shine. Like, what did you think of the kind of paltry stuff that they get to do in this film?
Well, I mean, Terry Polo especially, I feel like, have you heard of the sexy lamp test?
Ah.
So it's basically sort of feminist film theory where could you replace a female character with a sexy lamp, essentially? And I think Terry Polo probably fails the sexy lamp test in this, that she could be replaced with a sexy lamp because she does so little.
Mm-hmm.
Finds out she's pregnant, essentially. That's basically all that happens to her, isn't it? Like,
That feels like kind of justification in the film to just sideline her completely. Do you know what I mean? It's like all of the kind of comedy set pieces they have from that point on, it's like
she can't be in because she's pregnant. So it absolutely does. Like, it really doesn't do a service at all. I think Blythe Danner has a little bit more, but not really. Most of it is kind of like talking about her repressed sex life. And again, it's minimal at best.
We're talking about, like, feminist film theories. Like, this definitely fails the Bechdel test as well, right? Like,
completely. Yeah, absolutely.
Every conversation that any female is having in this film is about the male protagonists. Like,
completely.
It's Greg this or Jack that, or like, it's never like, how are you in yourself? Do you know what I mean? It's like even when Roz and Dina are having a talk, it's like, oh, I had your sex life with Jack. Like,
absolutely. It all boils down to Jack, doesn't it? In that family, he's the one who kind of like, and how Dina has not pulled Jack aside before this and said, "You're being a dick."
Yeah,
like, stop being a dick. How does that not happen? Like, that happens in my relationship all the time. Me and my wife will pull each other aside and be like, being a dick now. Like, stop it. Like, sort your life out. Like, we do it to each other a lot. Like, you know, so I just don't understand why that doesn't happen.
Which is what you want, because that is the thing. Like, the kind of protagonists of this film are both quite unlikable. Like, Ben Stiller and Robert De Niro's characters are quite unlikable guys, even though, like, Greg is, I mean, he works in an ER, he seems to be like a nice guy, he just wants things to go right for himself and stuff like that. He just handles everything like bullshit.
Yeah, there's a lot of, like, a lot of the humour is sort of, I mean, it's verging on unacceptable these days, right? So there's a lot of jokes about Greg's name being Gaylord, for a start. You know, I mean, I'm not sure that was funny in 2004. Like, you know, it was probably verging on being pretty awkward then. There's a lot of things about him being a male nurse and, like, being looked down upon because he's a male nurse. I'm like, it just feels a bit kind of, again, in 2004, I think that felt a bit off.
Yeah, there's a big vein of homophobia through this film. Like, and kind of anything that kind of leans towards like LGBTQ plus at all. Like, there is a line when they're playing football and Greg is the quarterback for both sides because it's 2-on-2.
Yeah.
And like someone says, oh yeah, Greg's going to go both ways. Jack's like, yeah, of course.
Of course
he does. And it's like, yeah, like, I get it. Like, you're portraying somebody who is from that kind of viewpoint in Jack, but at the same time, the film itself is goading the audience to be like, isn't that funny? Mm. Isn't it funny that his name is Gaylord Fokker? And it's like,
yeah.
Is it, though? Like, do you know what I mean?
Is it? Yeah. Is it that funny? Like, and also, he calls himself Greg. Everyone calls him Greg, right?
Yeah.
So why on his badge at work does it say Gaylord Fokker? It'd say Greg, wouldn't it, right?
Of course.
Like, why that's only on there to make a homophobic joke, right? That's the only reason it exists.
Yeah, like that, and that's like the first gag of the film, isn't it? And it's like,
yeah, it is.
Oh,
yeah,
you helped deliver our son. Like, oh, we'll name him after you. And it's like, I kind of from that moment was like, oh boy, I'm not sure if we're a good time here.
Oh boy, I was like, oh, this is an early 2000s movie, and then I was like, it's 2004. We were surely a bit past this by then. But maybe not. Maybe not. We're still terrible people.
Yeah. Well, America was still yet to elect or just elect George Bush for a second term. So they didn't know what the fuck they were doing.
True. True. That's fair. Maybe I'm putting today's values on a film that's nearly 20 years old. But still, I think it's in 2004. I distinctly remember some of the jokes being like, "Oh, I don't think that's okay." You know, like. So,
and then if they're not okay, they're kind of just a bit like paltry, like jokes,
a bit
like,
of shit. Yeah. They're not even good jokes. Like, come on,
you could see what the film is going for. Like, kind of wants to be a bit screwball, like kind of like mismatched family and stuff like that. But
I like that. Like, give me National Lampoons. Like, that's a screwball mismatched family comedy. Like, happy to do that, to watch that. That makes me, that's one of my favourite Christmas movies, Christmas Vacation. Like, but this, I don't know, it just doesn't work, doesn't fit. And then, yeah, and talking of kind of cameo bits, I guess, and small parts, like, they do drag Owen Wilson's character back into it at the end, don't they?
Yeah.
For no apparent reason other than he's Owen Wilson.
Yeah. Like, do you want to come down to Miami for a day, Owen? He's like,
all right.
Yeah, I'll calm down. Wow. I'll play the bagpipes. Wow. Yeah, it's kind of like, okay. And it's like, I know, looking back on this now, it's like, was there an element where like certain people from the first film were like, yeah, I'm not coming back. Like, or like, you would have thought like the wedding, the sister would have been there. It just all feels a bit confusing. Like, there's no reason.
Yeah.
Like, does it explain where the sister is? Like, I don't really like it.
Doesn't really explain where she is, does it?
No.
Yeah, that's weird. That's weird. That is weird. It's not great. This is just not great.
I'm reading this here just now. So the first film, and I think this is an interesting avenue to take this conversation. So the first film, at one point, was going to be directed by Steven Soderbergh, because first film is a remake of a 1992 film called Meet the Parents, which is like a super low budget. Indie film. Directed by Greg Gilliner, who kind of has, I think, stars in it as well. And like, yeah, it was made for like $100,000.
That was the National Lampoon's made for video thing, wasn't it?
Yeah. So really low budget. And then like, I think they realized like there is a bit more in this that we could make a remake of this. Steven Soderbergh was going to do it. And then Steven Spielberg was going to direct this film, like the first one, because obviously this is a DreamWorks film. DreamWorks is owned by Steven Spielberg. And yeah, he was going to do it with Jim Carrey in the lead role.
Wow, okay. That would have been a very different movie.
Yeah. Like
a very different movie, surely.
And I think would have been left at just the one. Like,
yeah.
And I think, would you have preferred to, I don't know what the Steven Soderbergh one would have been, because I think he was looking at doing it in like 95 and like decided to make out of sight instead, which was probably the right decision.
Yeah, probably the right decision. I don't know. Like, I can't even get my head around what a version of this movie with Jim Carrey would have been. Like, yeah, it would have been a very different movie.
And the film directed by Steven Spielberg as well.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Like, I mean, Spielberg not known for comedy, really.
Yeah.
Like, strange. Yeah. I don't know.
Imagine
you've stumped me now.
Imagine Steven Soderbergh's trilogy of films was the Meet the trilogy as opposed to the Ocean's trilogy. Do you know what I mean? Like, imagine that was what he did instead. Like, because what, Ocean's 11? That was 2000 as well, wasn't it? Like, imagine that was his kind of path instead. He did Meet the Parents, Meet the Fockers, and Little Fockers. No, thank you.
Instead of the Oceans.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. So what would he have been doing in like 2004 instead of this then? Like, oh, God knows, I don't know. But
think like Spielberg could have potentially took this film instead of doing Saving Private Ryan, for instance, depending on when it was like going to get off the ground. What a misstep that would have been. he could have done Meet the Parents instead of Saving Private Ryan.
So he did, like, Steven Soderbergh. So it's like he did Ocean's 12 in 2004, didn't he?
Yeah. So I think like the first two at least kind of match years. It's like 2004, and I'm not sure when 13 was. Maybe. Probably before 2010.
We did like Erin Brockovich in 2000 as well, didn't he?
Yes.
Like, so that's quite a... And then Solaris as well.
Oh, he did... No, 2000 was... Or was it 99? He did Traffic and Erin Brockovich and then like lost out the Oscar for Best Director for Erin Brockovich because he won the Oscar for... Traffic instead.
Like, yeah, yeah.
The guy was on a hot streak. If he had kind of sullied that by doing this film in 1995,
can you imagine?
If he did the original, yeah.
Yeah.
I think both Stevens kind of made the right decision here and left it.
I think so. Yeah,
left it to Jay Roach. What do you make of Jay Roach as a director? Like, were you aware of his kind of films?
So he did like Austin Powers, didn't he? I think that's where I kind of know him from. He did Austin Powers, or I made that up?
He did both. I think he did all three Austin Powers films.
Yeah, I think so. I think I know him from kind of Austin Powers. I'm not sure what else I know that he's done, to be honest.
He's tried to do in his later years. He did that in 2010. I guess he turned down doing Little Fockers, do Dinner for Schmucks, which from what I remember was not good.
Oh, was that?
The Paul Rudd and Steve Carell movie.
Oh, yeah. Is that the one where they have to bring someone to dinner who's really awful or something?
Yeah. It's like a remake of like a German film, I think.
Yeah,
it's
kind
of interesting. And then
just sounds fucking awful.
And then 2012, he did The Campaign.
Okay, that's
Will Ferrell.
Will Ferrell, yeah.
Zach Galifianakis.
Yeah, and I think that's pretty bad as well, isn't it?
It's not.
If I remember rightly.
It's not great. But then 2015, this is where it gets interesting.
Okay.
Is he directs Trumbo, the film about the kind of screenwriter who I think ended up on like the Hollywood blacklist because he had ties to communism at that kind of weird time in like Hollywood.
Oh, right, okay. I don't think I've seen that one. I've seen, but he did Bombshell, though, didn't he?
Yeah, he's tried to, I think, from what I'm gathering, is he saw Adam McKay, like kind of take this pivot to something that was like a bit more serious, kind of like faux documentary, like faux real life, and has gone, I'm gonna do that. Like he's kind of, with Trumbo, he's gone, if Adam McKay can do, what's the film about the crash? If he's done that one, I could do Trumbo, and then he's gone Bombshell. If he could do Vice, I could do Bombshell. Can you? Like, really?
Yeah. It's a bit of a pivot. It is a bit of a pivot. It's a weird kind of. It's a weird list of movies that he's made.
Yes, 100%. 100%. So one of the things I have on my list here, Rich, is if you were to cast your Hollywood parent, who would you cast?
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah,
That's an interesting one.
I'm throwing a curveball because I think that...
Who would I want as my Hollywood parents? So who are most like my parents or... Who I would want to play my parents.
Let's go. Who would be the perfect people to encapsulate your parents? Let's do that. Let's do that vein of it.
Oh, Christ. Oh, man, I don't know. Who would my dad want to play him?
Well, who would who would fit the bill?
It would have to be somebody relatively down to earth and a bit funny. So maybe not an all-out comedian, but capable of being a bit funny. I don't know. I'm struggling. I'm really struggling.
I know this is a difficult question.
Hard question.
So let's go with who would you want to be your Hollywood parents? Let's do that.
Who would I want to be my Hollywood parents? Who seem like good people? I don't know. I think everyone in Hollywood who is old enough to be my parent, my parents' age, feel like they should be a lot younger, if you know what I mean. Hollywood people age. I'm pretty sure Tom Cruise is a similar age to my dad.
Kurt Russell and is it Goldie Hawn? They could easily be my parents.
They would be good Hollywood parents, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
There you go. Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn. That's a good one.
Yeah,
I think, Tom Cruise is 2 years younger than my dad. So there you go. Tom Cruise could be my dad, but then I don't want to go for all the Scientology nonsense.
I think Nicolas Cage is a year older than my mum.
Yeah, it's mad, isn't it?
Yeah. So Cage could be my dad. Yes. I'd obviously take that in a heartbeat. And Patricia Arquette as my mum, I'll take those two any day of the week.
That's a nice combo.
Yeah.
But I can't think, mate.
I think the people who would if I were to cast two people to actually be my parents in a film, I think one, because the last film I ever saw in the cinema with my mum was the film Guilt Trip. Stars Seth Rogen and Barbara Streisand, and it's kind of about a slubby son and his kind of attentive mum. I was I think Babs could easily and me and my mum kind of related to the film. I was I'm a bit of a slub. You're very attentive and lovely. you're constantly going, what the fuck are you doing with your life? So I think Barbara Streisand could easily be my mum in that sense. And just because my stepdad looks like him, Robin Williams definitely play my stepdad.
Robin Williams is awesome, isn't he?
Yeah.
I'd love him to be my dad. that's a definitely Robin Williams could play my dad.
Amazing. Is there, yeah, before we start to wrap things up, is there any moments in this film that you feel like we should pick out? Because I feel like we've done a good job of talking around this film as opposed to talking about the actual film, which is normally a sign that the film isn't that interesting. And I think that kind of is the case here.
It's not that interesting, is it? There's not really nuanced performances to pick at. It loses its way towards the end, I think. Like there's a bit where you think this could be okay, and then actually the ending is pretty shocking. Like the whole wedding thing and
the convoluted
kind of road trip thing that goes on for no reason. Like Robert De Niro has a hissy fit and just drives off, and so they chase him down, and there's this weird kind of thing where they all end up in jail for.
And the whole like subplot of like, oh, the housekeeper, and it could be like his son.
Yeah,
they did an amazing job of casting that actor.
That kid, yeah, the kid does look like him.
He's I got Ray Santiago as Jorge Villalobos, like, looks perfect, like a kind of Hispanic Ben Stiller. Like, he's perfect.
Yeah.
But then, like, the kind of go around with that, because obviously there's a whole thing where Jack is doing, like, a DNA test, and then it's just like, oh, no, it was, like, some guy called, like...
Baseball player looks like Ben Stiller.
Yeah, it's just Ben Stiller in a... Is Ben Stiller browned up, like, sort of Hispanic? And he's like, oh, really?
Also dodgy. I mean, I kind of want to say that I like the dog getting flushed down the toilet. But maybe that's just me. Like, I just like the blue dog after he's been flushed down the toilet of the RV. Like, I think that's funny. But
there is a moment that kind of got me that, like, I was like, it was kind of guilty, but like, it's when Dustin Hoffman is like breakdancing, and like from the look of it, like when he does that headstand, it's like that, like, there's no cutaway or anything. It's like, oh, that is actually Dustin Hoffman dancing. And then he falls back through a table. And I was like, that's kind of sweet. And like, it's obviously played for a laugh, but I thought it's like more sweet of like, it's just this goofball. And it kind of really encapsulates who his character is. And I think, I can't kind of praise enough him and Barbara Streisand in this film, because kind of when they're on screen and they're like, they're interplay together and like...
Mm. Without them, this film would be unbearable.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I totally agree. They do hold it all together. But it's just, it's not a great movie, is it? It's not something we can delve into like deeply.
And it's not something that like... From like reading about it, there's no kind of like onset like conflict or like some interesting stuff around the film. It kind of feels like everyone who's involved.
I'm really sorry. I just picked the most boring film. No,
You haven't. You haven't. There are far worse films on this list, and they're probably ones that neither of us have ever heard of. Well, I've only heard of them because of this list. No, don't do that to yourself, Rich. Don't worry. This is always the gamble with this show, and I think it's what makes this show kind of interesting is the fact of there are these parameters, good or bad. Like, you could easily have a podcast. Anyone could have a podcast where it's like, hey, this week we're going to talk about a great film. Next week we're going to talk about a great film. The week after we're going to talk about a great film. A roll of the dice, baby.
And I think the thing is, it's easy to talk about a great film. It's easy to talk about a terrible film. It's hard to talk about a film that's kind of fine.
Yeah.
Like,
do you know what I mean? If you were on a long car, if you were on like a long coach journey and they put this on the screen, you'd be like, you know what?
It's all right, isn't it?
It's an hour and 50 minutes. Like, be fine. You know what I mean, it's a perfect plane film, I reckon. Like back, old school plane films as well, when it was like the screens in the aisle, not when you have ultimate choice. I mean, they're programming a film like those days, and you paid your money for your headphones. All right, we're watching Meet the Fockers. it's fine. It's fine. It literally is the death. You look up fine in the dictionary, you got Meet the Fockers there. Like, it's not revolutionary in any way.
No, no, it isn't.
So on that note, yeah, is there anything else that we've missed or that you have a burning desire to mention about this
movie? I don't think so. I think we've talked about everything from this movie.
And anything that we've missed it for a reason, because it wasn't
anything we've missed. It's because it was boring.
Amazing, amazing. That they feel like perfect closing thought on this film. So before I let you go, I must ask you a few questions, and the first of those being, did you manage to find any Coppola connections within this film? Is there anyone who is in this film or worked on this film that's worked with the Coppolas elsewhere?
I am. Not really. The only one I've got is Terry Polo on the West Wing, obviously with Martin Sheen. And this is Michael Sheen then. That would be a very different show with Michael Sheen. Obviously, worked in Apocalypse Now with Francis Ford Coppola. So there you go. That's a roundabout-ish kind of way.
Lovely, lovely. So I'll go in with like a nice little tenuous one to begin with, then I'll rattle through a list of ones that I've got. Don't feel bad not to have got any of these, Rich. I just have a kind of a beautiful mind style thing of being able to just...
Yeah, I mean, my knowledge of the Coppola family is not...
yeah. I could just close my eyes and see filmography scroll upon my eyelids. But the tenuous one is the sequel to this film, Little Fockers, is directed by Paul Weitz, who... directed and was co-creator along with Jason Schwartzman and Roman Coppola on the series Mozart in the Jungle. And then the more direct connections we have here is Ben Stiller was in Flirting with Disaster with Patricia Arquette, who at the time of that film's production was married to Nicolas Cage. He's also in Night at the Museum, Battle for the Smithsonian. John Schwartzman was the cinematographer. And he's in the Mark Peace Experience, which Jason Schwartzman also stars in. Nice, obvious one.
Robert obviously, like De Niro as well, you know.
De Niro's in Godfather Part 2. Yeah, that is next on my list. Dustin Hoffman is in All the President's Men, which David Shire did the score for and at the time was married to Talia Shire. He's also in I Heart Huckabees with Jason Schwartzman.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah, he is, yeah.
Is set to be in Francis Ford Coppola's next film, Megaropolis.
So okay.
We've got some future Dustin Hoffman Coppola connections there for you. I've got to take a deep breath for this one. It's Owen Wilson, ladies and gentlemen. Owen Wilson is in Armageddon, which John Schwartzman was the DOP. He also co-wrote Rushmore, which stars Jason Schwartzman. He's in The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, which Roman Coppola was the second unit director. He's in The Darjeeling Limited, which stars Jason Schwartzman and is co-written by Jason Schwartzman and Roman Coppola. He's in Night at the Museum 2, which John Schwartzman was the DOP. Fantastic Mr. Fox, which Jason Schwartzman is also in. He's in The Grand Budapest Hotel, Jason Schwartzman also in, and him and Roman Coppola also have co-writing credits on, and is in The French Dispatch, which Jason Schwartzman has a tiny cameo. And that's about it for Owen Wilson.
That's incredibly impressive.
I should have just said Owen Wilson, Wes Anderson. There's your connection, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, yeah.
But fun, isn't it? Dori Barton, who plays an airline clerk in this film, is in Bewitched. She plays a auditioning actress, which Jason Schwartzman is also in that film. And the score for this film is done by, as little as there is of it, it's done by Randy Newman.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Who also did the score for Seabiscuit, which John Schwartzman was the DOP. And this film makes a reference to Seabiscuit when
it does, yeah.
when Barbara Streisand is giving Robert De Niro a massage, when Ben Stiller's character enters the room, he says, "You are riding him like Seabiscuit." So for me, I was like, "Ah, John Schwartzman was the DOP on that film." It's interesting. So you really got to be, like really tuned into the Coppola family to get that joke. And it's not a good one, even if you do. Famous horse.
Lovely. Brilliant.
There we go. So let's rate this film, Rich. The way we do that here is we talk about the perfect wine pairing. So what would be the perfect wine pairing for Meet the Fockers?
So I've thought about this. Not a massive wine guy, I will be honest, but I think, because we've talked about this film is basically fine, I think it's going to be like a bog standard, like Jacob's Creek Merlot. Like, you know, nothing special, but if you brought it to a family dinner, everyone would be like, oh, yeah, that's all right. Nobody hates it.
Yeah.
You know, it's just that bog standard kind of all right.
I think this is like a relatively cheaper wine. And I'm going to go with a white wine, and it's going to be a spritzer, because that is a big moment throughout this film is Roz introduces Dina to spritzers and it becomes her drink. And
I think this is true, yeah.
And I think
I was going to say a Tom Collins or a chimichanga, the things that get talked about.
But I think in the way of a spritzer, because it's like, yeah, it's trying to have a bit of like light kind of fizz to it to make it fun, but like at the end of the day, the kind of the bitterness of the cheaper wine still cuts through. Not that good, actually.
That's a good one.
So how much are we paying for this wine, aka is this film any good? Is this a bottom shelf, middle shelf, or top shelf wine?
I mean, it's probably upper bottom shelf for me, but between the bottom and the middle.
Middle with a yellow label, I'm saying.
Yes, yeah. Middle with a yellow label, yeah.
Yeah. It's on that periphery, I think. It's on that kind of perineum between the bottom and the middle shelf. I've got to agree with you there. So based on this film alone, Rich, the Coppola's the greatest film family of all time?
I mean, based on this film, no. But
that's it. That's all I know.
Based on all the rest of their movies and all the other output, then probably.
That doesn't matter. It's this film alone. No. I'm taking your first answer, Rich, okay? So very shortly, I'm gonna kick you out of the circle of trust. But before I do, I must know the answer to these two vital questions. First of which being, which Coppola family member would you keep? But in doing so, you get rid of the entire filmographies of the rest of the collective family.
It's a tough one, and yet also an easy one. It's Nicolas Cage.
Yes, Rich. Yeah. Would you like to expand? I'm not sure if it needs to, but please.
I mean, I've just watched the Unbearable Weight of a Massive Talent, and I think it's the best thing he's done in ages. I absolutely love it. But also, I mean, I love lots of things that Nicolas Cage is in. I love National Treasure, and I'm not afraid to admit that. And both Dave and I are crying out for a National Treasure 3. Where is that?
I'm not sure the validity to it, but I saw something recently on social media, and it was one of those things where, you know, when like Twitter like instantly refreshes and you lose the article. And it was something to do with Nicolas Cage's slated to be in season 2 of the series that they're doing on National Treasure.
Yeah.
So hopefully,
fingers crossed,
with the revitalization of the franchise, they will kind of stump up the cash and make that third one. And I'm always put down by the fact of like Disney's reasoning for not continuing the franchise was basically like, we can't make money out of it beyond the films. Like we can't like,
we can't like sell toys of it and stuff.
We can't merchandise history, basically. Do you know what I mean? Like we can't start selling Declaration of Independences. Like you can have like a cool thing where if you slightly get it damp, it reveals a secret map on the back. People would go,
yeah. People would go nuts for that. But you could do a video game. You know, there's stuff you could do, surely. Like, nah, I don't buy that.
Yeah, they were probably like, video game.
You're not working hard enough.
They saw Uncharted come out and go, oh, shit, that's basically what we're doing.
That's basically it, isn't it?
That's basically what we're doing over here. Amazing. Yeah. Nicolas Cage. Yeah. He's the pro. And he's always fascinating. And like, it seems, especially recently, every other week, there's like new casting news for Nicolas Cage. And it's like, for me, it's like heartening. Cause it's like,
he seems to have gone through that period of just saying yes to everything to now saying yes to some really interesting stuff.
Yes.
Like maybe he's paid those debts off and now he's doing the really interesting stuff.
He has, yeah.
No more Ghost Rider. Much more Pig, please. Like that's what we're talking about.
Well, yeah, in the promo for Massive Talent, I think he did like a, he kind of admitted, yeah, like I'm debt free now. Like I can kind of, I can be a bit more selective, but he still seems to be working at a clip and like,
yeah,
still kind of churning them out. And I think we're yet to see stuff that maybe, I think he's got like 6-7 things like in his, like to be released IMDb. And it's like, please.
Yeah. Bring it on.
Amazing. So I must ask you the final and arguably most important question of this podcast.
Yeah.
What does notorious throwing kids in bin Bill Murray say to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation, Rich?
I thought about this quite a lot. And I don't know if someone else would have said this, but for me, other than Ghostbusters, Bill Murray's best role is in Caddyshack.
Oh, okay.
And so I think what he would say is the thing he says when he's about to blow up the golf course to get rid of the gopher. He says, in the immortal words of Jean-Paul Sartre, au revoir, gopher. And I think that's what he's whispering. Au revoir, gopher.
Yeah, I think that's perfect. Yeah, no further questions on that. So let us know before you go, where can people find yourself and the Unequal Sequel podcast, or where's the best place to keep in touch?
Well, I mean, for the podcast, we're in everywhere you get your podcasts from. You literally can't get away from us. Just type in Unequal Sequel and we'll be there. In terms of kind of social media stuff, then if Twitter still exists when this goes out, you can find us on Twitter or on Instagram. We're at Unequal Sequel. You can, I mean, if you want to get in touch with us, you can send us an email because we're properly off of the 90s and email us at unequalsequel@hotmail.com. I even built us a website, which it seems like a pointless endeavor for a podcast, really. But yeah, unequalsequel.com, you can find us on there too.
It's a beautiful website. And I always, listening to your podcast, it always like, I always get a smile on my face that the fact that you guys have a Hotmail account.
Yeah, I know. Email. It's become a thing now.
It's amazing.
We can't get rid of it.
Do you ever like email people from that account, like potential guests,
time.
And they go like
all the time?
What, you emailing from a Hotmail account? Like,
yeah, we're from the past.
I think the first time I heard it, I was like, do they even still give out Hotmail accounts? Like, how long have you guys had this account in waiting? I love
that. Yeah, blame Dave for that one. He set that one up. But yeah, it's become a big running thing now, so we can't get rid of it.
I love it.
You know, 20 years' time, we'll still have a Hotmail email address.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Yeah, so many. Yeah, everyone's Gmail. It's so hack and played out. Bring back Hotmail. It seems like, yeah, everyone's thirsting for things of the past. Even recently in a group chat, we're like, social media is on its arse. Like, is there any way we can resurrect MySpace? Like,
I was just going to say that. Yeah. Twitter's dying. MySpace it is then.
Yeah, yeah. MySpace and MSN chat rooms. Yes, please. Let's bring
MySpace, there's just lots of links to your friend's shitty band.
and the added social of anxiety of, oh, what if this person hates me because they're not in my top eight?
Brilliant.
Or seeing yourself drop out of a top eight and be like, oh, they must hate me now.
Oh God.
Well, before we get trapped down a kind of nostalgia trip, thank you so much, Rich, for coming and making some Copa connections with me.
Thanks, mate. Cheers. It's been really fun. Thank you.
So there we have it, guys. Rich voted no. Based on Meet the Fockers, the Coppolas are not the greatest film family of all time. Another massive thank you to Rich for coming and joining me for this. It was a lot of fun. It's often quite hard to talk about these mediocre movies, but I think we got there. I think we had a great time doing it. There's plenty of avenues and stuff to talk around this film, so that was a lot of fun. And a massive thank you to you guys for listening. And if you would like to get in touch with the podcast, if your opinions on this film differ, if they are the same, if you want to carry on the conversation, you can do so by heading over to Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Letterboxd, Hive, I guess we're on Hive now, and TikTok, all at Caged In Pod. Or you can drop me an email. Email's not going anywhere, unlike social medias. Who knows where any of those will be in the distant future. We're soon approaching a new year, maybe a new landscape. But to be honest, I'm going to be there with Twitter till the dying days. Elon Musk or not. Drop me an email, which, as I said, isn't going anywhere, which is cagedinpod@gmail.com. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you can head on over to patreon.com/cagedinpod and give me some cash money for doing what I'm doing. It really helps kind of keep the lights on. Anything that needs to be tinkered with, fixed, bought for the podcast, all the money goes back in. Hopefully get me to do fun, interesting things, make the podcast sound better and better and better and better, so you guys can have a enjoyable show to listen to, interact with, and enjoy most of all. However, if you don't want a part of any money, you can head on over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening to this right now and leave a lovely 5-star rating and review. And when you do leave that rating and review, let me know in that review what you think Bill Murray says to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation. As for next week on the podcast, it's going to be another great episode. You know what? I'm going to stop telling you guys what it is. You're going to have to follow on the socials. You get a little, you'll get a little tease of what it's going to be. You can always, look on my letterbox. You'll figure it out pretty quickly. But I think in the episodes, I'm going to kind of, let me be honest with you, I don't know what next week's episode is. That's why I'm being quite aloof about it. But it's going to be a fun one altogether. We'll start slowly gearing up for Christmas, so there's plenty of Christmassy goodness coming. However, we'll get to all of that in good time. As ever, guys, I've been Petros Patsilivus, your guide through the crazy world of the Coppola family tree. Remember to keep it caged in, and I'll catch you next time.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Pod Charles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drip Town Limerie, Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.